Kia ora tātou. I'm Joe Hollander. I'm Chair of the Defence Heritage Advisory Group, and I also am Director of the Engineer Corps Memorial Centre. So it's my pleasure tonight in connection with the Palmerston City Library to welcome you here for our second evening public lecture for the year. Now, I think I explained previously that this year's program is focusing on anniversaries. And so this year in particular, we've got a whole raft of anniversaries, significant anniversaries, on our commemorations program. And so tonight, we're commemorating the 160th anniversary of Queen Alexandra's Mounted Rifles. And we're absolutely delighted to have the commanding officer here tonight, Colonel Jacob Murray, given Anzac Day commitments and a number of other things. It's great to have you with us, Jake. So, look, without further ado, I think I'll hand over to Jacob, and he'll handle questions and so on at the tail end of the presentation. So please welcome Jacob.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko rua pēku te maunga, ko rangatiki te awa, ko kahununu, te iwi. Hei, Commanding Officer, Queen Alexandra's Mounted Rifles, ko Jacob Murray, tōku ingoa. A very, very good evening. Firstly, Joe, the fact you've described me as giving a lecture would give my former teachers at Palmerston Police High School palpitations that I've been trusted with such an academic sort of stance, get my results at school. But anyway, we'll now move past that. Look, I need to start off with a bit of a disclaimer. Some of you with eagle eyes might have noticed that on the poster to start off, it talked about had the term or the acronym RNZIR. Those of you who've served before will know that's the Royal New Zealand Infantry Regiment. I'm an infanteer by background, having served both at 2nd 1st Battalion in Burnham and here at the 1st Battalion Royal New Zealand Infantry Regiment as a company commander, but it has been the highlight and the honour of my service so far to command Queen Alexandra's Mounted Rifles and as the most steeped in tradition regiment within the Army and to be honest, within the Defence Force as well, given its history. So tonight, I hope to do that justice. If the questions don't get too technical, I should be okay. But the great thing about the regiment is the history is always sort of front of house, and that therefore gives us a good baseline to sort of get into. I must also, too, before we carry on, he's not here tonight, but I must very much thank Lieutenant Matt Thompson, one of my troop leaders, who assisted in putting the presentation together, the unit history officer, and I just want his name out there in case it doesn't go too well, but otherwise he deserves some of the credit. And again, Joe, thank you very, very much for the invite to come along. So just going back, as I said, founded 1864, I'll get into the detail, but this year is the 160 years of the regiment, which in a country like New Zealand, given our historic timeline, is really quite something. You'll see there, the bottom left of the screen is the guidon, which we'll get into more detail about. So, I guess the story of Queen Alexandra's Mounted Rifles is the story of New Zealand, in essence. Tonight we'll look at the history of the New Zealand Land Wars. By the way, is anyone here from sort of Whanganui up towards New Plymouth? Anyone originate from places like Waverley, Pātia? Haora, this is going to, yep, very, very good. Well, you know, this is almost your story as well. And then in the origins, mm-hmm. and then we sort of branch out. And then we go through and say the early conflicts, the Boer War, World War One. We'll spend a bit of time there. There's some very, very interesting sort of stories, not just Gallipoli, but also into the Middle East, Palestine. Unfortunately, Gaza, which is sort of hasn't really sorted itself out over a century later. And then we look at the interwars and mechanisation. And by mechanisation, it's moving from horses to armoured vehicles in the early stages of that within New Zealand as we move in towards World War II. And as we move into World War II, we look at how armour has been employed within the divisional construct, both in the Middle East and also the Pacific. And when we think of the Pacific, it's not really an environment where we see armoured vehicles being easily used. However, even today, it's a requirement, but we still have problems sort of seeing how that can be utilised. Then after World War II, we move into the Cold War years, and we also move into the advent or the beginning of the Royal New Zealand Armoured Corps. Now you'll notice the belt I wear, the stable belt, is the regimental belt. It is not the belt of the Royal New Zealand Armoured Corps, which is different, because personnel from the Royal New Zealand Infantry Regiment, the Royal New Zealand Armoured Corps, the Royal New Zealand Signals, and Royal New Zealand Army Logistics Regiment make up Queen Alexandra's Mounted Rifles. And as Joe himself, as a former service person, will know, QAMR is quite distinct in that everybody in the regiment wears the same dress distinctions, i.e. the belt and the badge on the beret, regardless of what corps you are from, which is unique to QAMR. The Cold War years will take us through to the modern era, and some of you again have served or start to become a bit more familiar. And then we come into, I guess, some decisions that have been made in the last few decades leading to our current capabilities, but also too, I'll pose some questions about where we might be going from here within classification levels, of course, but we'll, and then from there we'll have some questions. I haven't got a coffee for me to keep myself awake, but I apologise, I'm starting to drone on a bit too much for you. So, into it. Sources. Now, Kiwi Trooper is a Bible of sorts, written in, I think, 1967. And then we move through some of the other publications. But the bottom one I really want to highlight, Matthew Wright has just completed his book, Those Who Have the Courage, which is the history of the Royal New Zealand Armoured Corps and its predecessor forces. So I haven't copied his whole book for tonight's presentation. I have put a bit more effort into it than that. But I would say that is an amazing reference when you're looking at the history of New Zealand's armoured forces and what came before with the horse-mounted personnel, or the horse-mounted troops. Both Joe and I attended the book launch at the Palmerston North Cosmopolitan Club, when was it?
A couple of weeks ago.
So that's out there now. It's a big book. It's a big bit of kit. It's quite heavy. There's a lab to transport it pretty much. But what it has is everything the detail in that is fantastic, and Matthew really deserves credit for what he's put out. Okay, so starting back. So the story of the New Zealand Army begins in 1845 when the governor of the day passed the Ordnance Act. In 1845 is generally acknowledged as being the creation of the New Zealand Army, which led to the creation of the militia. If you've done a bit of study into the New Zealand Land Wars, it's quite a fascinating view. I mean, in my previous unit, we went for a look with Cliff Simons, a very renowned New Zealand Army historian, up into Waitara, and moving back through towards Stratford, and you look at some of the what happened in the early days of settlement with regards to the land occupations and what happened with the land sales, and you start to actually get an understanding of it was almost, you know, these are commercial ventures from the UK. This wasn't a sort of a mass settlement, but each of these settlements, as the tensions rose with local Māori, you then had a tensions raising, and people were raising their own defence groups. And this is where you have such terms as the Kaiwi Cavalry. Now, I've been to Kaiwi, I've family history in Waverley, etc., and I thought of Kaiwi having its own cavalry is quite interesting, but you've got the Kaiwi Cavalry, Wairoa, then the Waverley Cavalry, Pātia Yeomanry, I think is the term. And this goes right up into the Taranaki. This happened up in the Waikato too, as you had the conflicts up in the Waikato and up into the Bay of Plenty as well. So New Zealand was sort of dominated by these volunteer mounted forces that sprung up to defend their settlements. The The tough part about looking at Queen Alexandra's Mounted Rifles is keeping hold of the golden thread. So from 1864 until now, the regiment sort of ebbs and flows through our history, and we have to hold the golden thread. So what we've done tonight is to try and stay on that path and show you. But you, as you can see there, the Alexandra troop was first stood up in Whanganui on the 11th of August, 1864. It was named, well, sorry, first of all, it was accepted for service on the 16th of September, and that accepting it for service was the creation or the date that we now celebrate and still celebrate today, the regimental birthday for QAMR. Interestingly enough, you have a prominent settler by the name of Henry Shafto Harrison was elected captain. And that word elected is very important because unlike today where we go through training and selection to be officers, etc., etc., he was elected. And this sort of speaks, I guess, to the very British origins that pertained, you know, and if you go back into, if you understand the British Army history, commissions in the army were bought and afforded to people of higher status, and that sort of has been that way for quite, until relatively recently in comparison to the whole British history. So this piece here really does speak to, you know, a sort of home guard, settler, militia, but also the impact of the British, and especially as these are cavalry organisations or seen as cavalry organisations. Now, whilst it might be very tough for a country like New Zealand to think of that sort of class system affecting the military, that was probably, yeah, you know, that's the case. So he was elected by the soldiers, but he wasn't appointed by the government. Now, the strength of that unit was about 30 people at that, or 30 soldiers at that time. You'll notice there that it was named in the honour, named in honour of the new Princess of Wales, formerly Princess Alexandra of Denmark, who married Prince Edward, who just married Prince Edward, who was the Prince of Wales. So that's where the name Queen, and she later became Queen Alexandra. That's where the Queen Alexandra term comes from. That painting sits in my office. It was purchased at a second-hand store, which was one of the buyers, the best buyers he's done, he's done relatively recently. But she was a very striking woman and sort of seen as one of the great beauties of the day, I guess, would have been a Princess Di type figure. Well, she was a Princess Di before Princess Di, obviously, but back in that time frame. So it's, again, it's just, it's a little unique thing we have with QAMR that, again, doesn't really, hasn't occurred in other army units because the rest of the New Zealand Army is so much, has come so much later. Now, individual members of the troop, you'll note that, saw action during the New Zealand Land Wars. And by that, they might have been attached to or found themselves in different sort of small units that were part of skirmishes or part of sort of, I guess you'd say, isolated actions as tensions rose between Māori settlements and the Pākehā settlements trying to establish settlers. There's not sort of, you know, we hear about Gate Pā and sort of these battles, but in the main, these were sort of quite low level. And as you'll say there, the troop was largely limited to dispatch riding and garrison duties. Now, the modern soldier will tell you if their job is to carry messages and just look after the local garrison environment, they're probably looking for jobs at Fonterra pretty quick, because that is not exactly the most exciting soldiering. And so the next point there, when they were disciplined for abandoning their garrison to go and lance wild pigs, is not actually it's not an exaggeration. That actually occurred in the troop. And therefore, the troop was disestablished in October 1865, but this is the business as usual for the day where the troop was disestablished, re-raised as required, and I'll get onto that in the next slide. As I said before, raised and disbanded multiple times over the next 3 years, but you can see there in 1874, word finally came back from the UK that Princess Alexandra had given her blessing. And if I'll read out the words there, Princess Alexandra of Wales most graciously accedes to the request and is proud to know that the Cavalry Corps in faraway New Zealand bears her name. That's from Kiwi Trooper. So she finally got a letter back saying thank you very much and proud to be known as Queen or Princess Alexandra's Troop at the time, or Alexandra's Troop, which became Queen Alexandra's Mounted Rifles. Now, in 1881, I'm sure many of you, if not all of you, are familiar with the Parihaka. What happened to Parihaka? Te Whiti, a peaceful occupation of Parihaka and protest of the settlements up in the Taranaki. So the mounted rifles, including personnel from QAMR, were dispatched along with the armed constabulary out there to effect the arrest of Te Whiti. The interesting thing is how this is described. Now, I've taken the word Parihaka operation. There is Parihaka invasion, and there's an assault on Parihaka. If you read about it, there wasn't an assault. An assault is a very aggressive action. It was effectively an arrest of Te Whiti surrendered peacefully, as did the leaders and the arms assembly. That, but Queen Alexandra's Mounted Rifles, the Alexandra troop at the time, was part of that operation. And as you can see there, the fortunes of the troop ebbed and flowed over the years, and probably the next thing that sort of spurred, I guess, defence being frontal lobe in New Zealand at the time was the Russian scares of the late 19th century, when they were scared that Russia might sort of come to the Pacific and invade, so therefore that was when it was raised again. But now I want to move into the Boer War. Now, the Boer War is the first overseas or expeditionary sort of event for the regiment. You'll notice there too, the volunteers, it was all volunteers, and in October, 21st of October 1899, the first group departed Karori. Beyond those Karori well, up on the sort of by the RSA there on the opposite sort of, it used to be a school, or it's quite an open field as a school, etc. That's where they left from. And last year, Wellington East Coast Squadron paraded there with South African Defence Force veterans, not veterans of the Boer War, that would be a medical miracle, but those South African Defence Force veterans paraded there and to recognise that, which is a pretty special commemoration. And then they left, as you can see there. Now, there were 10 rotations in total, with over 6,000 New Zealanders fighting in the war. And again, a small number were drawn from the Alexandra's Mounted Rifles. Now, at this stage here, we're not talking about the regiment. We're talking about, again, small troops, regionally focused or locally focused, in line with how the Territorial Army was established. It says the history says how well the New Zealand forces acquitted themselves in battle, and then the wide rolling South African belt was perfect country for the mounted riflemen. I just want to stop here and talk about the mounted riflemen and the difference with cavalry. Cavalry in the sense of horses remained on the horse. They fought with bladed weapons on their horses and were used to encircle or sort of pursue. You'll see it on the movies when the cavalry are sort of unleashed to sort of have that decisive effect on the enemy. The mounted rifles rode and were able to use the horses to rapidly move or manoeuvre around to gain advantage over the enemy. But when it was time to fight, they fought as infantry with rifles. So that's the difference. And that echoes today too in how we view the employment or the capability of QAMR, which I'll get to later on. So this is not cavalry, this is mounted rifles, and it's very important too when we get into World War I and such sort of famous actions as the Light Horsemen of Beersheba, etc. So that's this is a, and I guess this is almost a distinctly, it's probably seen as a distinctly New Zealand Australian thing. But when you go into the history of mounted rifles, there's French sort of terms, and I guess all the countries have it, but that's the distinction with the cavalry, and that's really important. And then again, the argument just keeps coming back and back and back, and we don't really learn the lessons of history as we look to the capability of the role, but I just want you to bear that in mind. You'll see there that, you know, casualties in the Boer War were more sort of from the disease, again, New Zealanders probably had served many, had probably been overseas into Africa, and then I guess the sort of for the horses and the men themselves, the diseases that that sort of permeated. And then you've seen it there. So they use their speed and mobility to move to the best terrain, dismount and fight with long rifles or carbines. That is effectively why we have bought the Bushmaster, you know, last year. But I'll get to that later on. Now, the gentleman on the right is Farrier Sergeant W.J. Harden Farrier, which is obviously known as Farrier with the horses, and the support to that. He was awarded the Victoria Cross in 1901. And I've got his citation here, which I'll just read out, or the wording around the citation. It was an action near Newport in the Transvaal that the only New Zealand Victoria Cross was won by Farrier Sergeant W.J. Harden, a well-known Wellingtonian footballer, on 20th January 1901. As part of a general advance, a party of 12 New Zealanders was ordered to take a Kopje. No enemy were to be seen, but when Harden, McPhee and McRae were close up to it, the hot fire was opened up by about 20 Boers concealed there. A rush was made for cover, but McRae was wounded and his horse shot dead. Harden galloped back 40 yards, jumped off and hoisted McRae onto his horse, and gripping the stirrup iron, ran alongside until they were under cover. McPhee also lay badly wounded, so Harden, Sexton no doubt, galloped back under close range fire and got to him too, bandaged him up, and when the Boers were driven off, got him into an ambulance. 2004, the actions of Willie Appiah sound quite similar to that if you look at it. Now, he was originally mentioned in dispatches, but with the input of the Prime Minister at the time, Prime Minister Sett, it was upgraded to a Victoria Cross. So, and any of you familiar with Wellington Club Rugby, Harden Cup? That's it. Right, so after the Boer War, we move into Gallipoli and the desert. And we'll spend a bit of time here because this is the zenith of mounted rifles on horseback. So the Defence Act in 1909 amalgamated the scattered volunteer units into large entities, and this was the first sort of efforts to actually sort of build formations of regiments, etc. So you start having the Auckland, the Wellington, the Canterbury, and the Otago. And if you know, again, the infantry were the same, and we still had that geographic piece when we looked at World War I. As you can see, in 1912, the Alexandra Squadron became Queen Alexandra's 2nd Wellington West Coast Mounted Rifles, Queen Alexandra's own. The names get very, very long. My signature block would probably crash email if I sort of kept these names, so it's quite good. We've rationalised that because it gets pretty complicated later on. And on the 15th of October 1914, they embarked for Egypt with the Mounted Rifles. So they were part of the ANZAC Divisional Mounted Rifles as part of the New Zealand Mounted Rifles Brigade, with each regiment being geographically assigned Auckland, as I said, Auckland, Wellington, Canterbury, Otago. So after a period of training and security in Egypt, they were told to park up their horses, or they literally leave the horses under supervision, and they were off to Gallipoli to fight as infantry. Which is, yeah, and we know what happened there, but I'm going to go through a couple of events. By the way, Zaitoun Camp is the place in Egypt that they trained. The top picture denotes mounted rifles moving through Cairo, whilst the middle photo there, I believe, is personnel from either Wanganui or Waverley, and all over in Egypt together. So if that was from even Wanganui back in those days, there's not too many people left back in Wanganui, I'd take it, because...
Big force.
Yeah. I mean, the population of New Zealand at this time was a million, if that. Yeah. And we had probably 100,000 people, I believe, serving in the sort of total of World War One. And I see those numbers over in Australia the other day, and your eyes sort of pop out. There's two sort of battles I talk about. So the surrounded riflemen took casualties. So Chanakbeer. We're all aware of Chanakbeer, and I guess the story of Malone and the Wellingtons and the seizure of Chanakbeer, and the closest the Allied forces probably got to their objective in Gallipoli. Just once the Wellington battalion under Malone had taken or got on top of Chanakbeer, then the Wellington Mounted Rifles were used to reinforce. And there's Major Elmsley from Waverley. Major Elmsley was one of the ones who led the Wellington Mounted Rifles up to Chanakbeer, where he was also recommended for the Victoria Cross. And it says here, Such is glory. It must here be mentioned that Major General A. Godley, later Lieutenant General Sir Alexander Godley, who retained command of the NZEF throughout the war, refused to recommend any officer for the Victoria Cross. So therefore, Corporal Cyril Bassett, Singler, was the only New Zealander to receive a Victoria Cross in Gallipoli. But Major Elmsley, who was killed, was buried on Chunuk Bear, was recommended for it, but of course the policy stopped it. Once the Wellington Mounted Rifles had got into the top of Chunuk Bear, they got into the trenches, they tried, they set up defensive, they were then relieved, taken back off the hill. British infantry went up the top, and then the Turks, a massive counterattack. And by massive, I mean the mass of the numbers, pushed them off, and Chunuk Bear was lost. The next battle was Hill 60. Hill 60 itself was a northwest of Chunuk Bear, was seen as an attempt to move up to sort of secure more high ground to try and sort of again punch a hole through the defences to try and again sort of seek the sort of advantage of the high ground. The Mounted Rifles were again used for that, and by this stage the strength of the Wellington Mounted Rifles, which had a, which is a regiment, just bear in mind a regiment, within that was a, the one of the squadrons was Queen Alexandra's own. Strength was down to, I believe, seven officers and 72 other ranks. Okay. If that's the strength of QAMR, I'm going looking for everyone who's sort of not at work for that day. It is well under 50% of what I currently have. But this is the strength through attrition at Gallipoli. So this is the indication of where it was really sort of starting to hurt. Of course, we then have the evacuation from Gallipoli, and this is where I'll talk about reinforcements. And I'm going to read you a letter, a diary entry from an officer, Lieutenant J. Robertson from Waverley, who's part of the 8th Reinforcements. Inside Toon Cap, in 20th November 1915. We arrived at Port Suez on Saturday 24th, but did not disembark until Sunday dinner time. The first train left at 4 o'clock. E Squadron went on it, except for one NCO, five men and myself, who were told to guard 200,000 rounds of ammunition we'd bought from New Zealand. We were to land at X, but there was a big magazine. It stands under a huge cliff on the top of what was an old temple where Moses struck the rock and brought forth water. The line passes through beautiful, fertile country where lucerne, excuse my pronunciation, maize and sugar cane are growing. There are all camps around here, and Zaytun is about 6 miles from Cairo. I met Major Edgar and he showed me around. I saw Major Elmsley, as I talked about before, and Lieutenant Duncan's horses. Duncan's old single file is looking well. My word, Major Elmsley has made a great name for himself out here. Everyone seems to know him. He has proved himself a great soldier. It's quite pertinent for me because that letter was written by my great-grandfather. So that's, Lieutenant Robinson from Waverley is my great-grandfather. And in researching this, I sort of said, okay, what's he done? I have got his commissioning parchment, which is 107 years old, and his course report from his officer's courses. Sorry?
Did he pass?
Yeah, it's a bit of a match. His course report from Zaytun Camp, which again is done 1916. They're on the wall of my office along with his photo. When I looked up his history, I had to go to the Warrior Museum. I was told he embarked from Waverley as part of the Mounted Rifles, Queen Alexandra's Mounted Rifles, or the Wellington Mounted Rifles with Queen Alexandra's own. Got there and said, right, you're into the Auckland Mounted Rifles, so like Baden Barrow going to the Blues from Hurricanes. And then from there, it was told, right, park your horse up, you're going to go with the Otago Battalion to the Western Front. He got appendicitis, went to hospital, convalesced, and was sent home. A rather humble war experience, and I sort of felt quite deflated. I was like, oh, okay, there we go. But then I thought to myself, if he'd gone to the Western Front as a platoon commander, what was his chances of living and would I be here today? So I think appendicitis probably won out the day, and I'll take that one, thank you very much. Right, from the Gallipoli evacuation, the survivors were redeployed to Egypt, the Sinai and Palestine. And then we had the battles in the Sinai. Again, New Zealand personnel are currently serving there. Joe, did you go there with the engineers?
The Sinai?
Yep. So you've got the person, New Zealand is still serving there with the Sinai. My father went there with the Air Force. And you've, again, this part of the world, we don't seem to learn our lessons. No. We're still there all the time.
It's the old
So we had the Battle of Romani, and the fourth, as you can see there, in the Battle of Rapha. Now, I brought another book along today, which talks, written by Peter Fitzsimons, ex-Wallaby and Australian writer. He's written a book about the White Horse, or the charge of Australia, the White Horse at Beersheba. And as you can see there, what this culminated in was Beersheba, with the chart with the Light Horseman, which the movie was made about, is obviously a massively famous in Australia and worldwide, has been seen as the last great cavalry charge, or the last charge on horseback. But there's a couple of things he writes in here about New Zealand which I think are really pertinent. So he talks about, I'm just finding here, but bookmarked. He talks here about the arrival of the Wellington Mounted Rifles on the flanks here as Australians, but it goes through and he talks about here about New Zealand Mounted Rifles at Rapha, which is here. And he says, excuse me. Oh, sorry, I seem to have lost my bookmark. So the Auckland, Colonel Charles Maxey, the commanding officer of the Auckland Rifles, is the first to cross the border into Rapha, and does so alone, savouring the moment and piously thanking the Lord for allowing him to enter the Holy Land in such a mission as this. In the first action, the New Zealanders are able to storm and then swarm all around the trench to capture both Turkish soldiers and a few stunned German officers. The most senior of the latter tells Maxey in passable English that while the Kiwis are impressive, this is one of the German officers saying this, not even they will be able to finish the job and overcome the heavily fortified position. All right, we'll see, Maxey replies, bemused. We're going to have a go. We'll tell you later on. True, it is not quite Henry V's St. Crispin Day speech, but it is the Kiwis' understated way of going about things. Just get on with it, and we can chat later. Sure enough, as the battle proceeds throughout the day, the New Zealand Mounted Rifle Brigade encompassing the Auckland, Wellington and Canterbury Mounted Rifles regiments is outstanding. Still late in the afternoon, things have stalled. Major Henry White, one of the Auckland Mounted Rifles, doesn't care to hear that, and rising out of the line, yelling for his men to follow him, charges forward. Royston, Brigadier Royston, was an Australian commander, can bear it no more, yelling to his own troops of the 3rd Light Horse Brigade, attack at once, or those New Zealand bastards will take the lot. So you had a competition between Kiwis and the Aussies to see who could actually secure the objective. And again, Peter Fitzsimons is very, very, his plaudits for the New Zealand Mounted Rifles are pretty clear. As you can see there, and as I said before, this was the advance from Romani right across to Beersheba. And that is the high water mark for Mounted Rifles operations in World War I, because after that, it was off to the Western Front to fight his infantry. And such places as Passchendaele come into our sort of history, and it didn't go so well. So and this is often forgotten. And Devils on Horseback by Lieutenant Colonel retired Terry Kinlock, that book really does outline this campaign. So moving into war and mechanisation. So moving out of horses and onto armoured vehicles was not exactly a quick process. There was a lot of reluctance to give away with the horses. Still had horses. 927, the Mounted Rifles were formed again. In 929, the QAMR Gidon. Other corps or regiments in the army, we have colours, but Gidon is the cavalry, or Gidon is what you have in the QAMR. So that's the difference. It was presented to the regiment in Waverley, which is shown in the top photo, the camp, and that marking its battle honours and solidifying its ethos. So marking battle honours is a battle honour has to be accepted, that you can fly it on your colours. So battle honours for, say, a 1RNZIR might have South Vietnam, but not Timor Leste, for example. So despite the slow trickle of armoured vehicles and green gun carriers, horses were used right in 1939. And I guess when the Germans invaded Poland in 1939, a lot of the Polish were on horseback too. The Polish cavalry still tried to fight panzer tanks, etc., and the German mechanised forces on horseback. The fledgling state of the army is shown down the bottom. That's Bob Semple's tank. It is a tractor chassis. He was the Minister of Works at the time, and in his factory or workshop in Temuka, he came up with that tank with 6 .303 machine guns. I think a few examples were given off to the army, and they decided that no, it's not probably not going to do the business against the Japanese, so therefore we'll give it a miss. But it shows that how hard armour was to get in the early days. Moving to the Second World War, and this is a real change for mounted rifles. Stood up a divisional cavalry, so back to cavalry from mounted rifles, as a way of introducing armour to the NZF and 2nd New Zealand Division, which is obviously going through the Middle East. So New Zealand soldiers are once again deployed to Egypt and to North Africa, but this time they're on Vickers light tanks and Bren gun carriers instead of horses. If you go into the Wairau Museum, on the ground floor near the kids area, that's the main area, I always spend the Wairau Museum these days with the kids, there's a great scene set with the soldiers eating their baked beans and breakfast under the canyon with the Bren gun carrier. Mm. Okay, so that's that North African example. So on December 1942, QAM Argus, this is Queen Alexandra's Mounted Rifles Armoured Regiment. So we've still got the name, we're still sort of moving through, and the New Zealand Armoured Corps is formed in 1942. But the Mounted Rifle is now fully mechanised. So armour is, in this case, in divisional cavalry is used in reconnaissance to get deep, to find out where the enemy is. But with tanks, light tanks, these things here are light tanks, or in some cases infantry tanks, infantry support, or almost reconnaissance and trying to find what's going on in the deep lines of the German sort of areas and trying to find where those lead German elements are so that you can cue the battle on your terms, I guess is how I describe it, which is a change from World War One. So we see the armoured corps fighting in Italy, Greece, North Africa and the Pacific. And whilst the top photo there is, I believe, that like Sherman's moving up to Trieste, which was the advance as far as we got in Italy, which is actually almost on the, I'm going to say Slovenian border, almost on the border at the northern part of Italy. Down below here, we see light tanks coming ashore at Guadalcanal. That's a colour photo in the Pacific. So again, you've got the number of vehicles they used there, and then we deployed to Guadalcanal. Again, tracks in the jungle work quite well because trees just fall over. Wheels a little bit different. So there's actually quite interesting photos of tracked vehicles on both sides being used in the Pacific when people, even to today, just assume that we can't operate there. As I said before, New Zealand Army units advanced to Trieste at the close of the war and then some into the occupation duties in Europe and Japan after the Axis surrender. So that was World War II. I know I've rushed through World War II a bit there, but I feel like, the mounted rifles term deserves, the mounted rifles part deserves a lot more sort of emphasis because of that was almost a unique New Zealand piece along with the Australians. I think New Zealand's initial foray into armour and tanks, as you see as we go forward, it never really got to any great heights. And I guess when we look at World War II, it was the exploits of the 2nd New Zealand Division. Yes, we had the armoured, and the combined arms or use of armour and infantry with artillery, etc. And the combined arms in the desert was successful and allowed sort of victories at places like El Alamein. But I think there's some more sort of poignant parts for the regiment to move on to. So we move into the Cold War. So the Royal New Zealand Armoured Corps is gazetted in 1947, and then the next one in 1948, as you can see how we start to get a bit of alphabet soup for how we name all these units. I guess I'd highlight for the given where we are, the Manawatu two mounted rifles or the 6th Light Armoured Fighting Regiment. Yeah, it sort of shows too, again, this is when the territorial force was still the dominant player in the army setup. As we move through, a very famous name in the New Zealand Army is the Scottish, New Zealand Scottish. So Regiment October 48, they became an armoured unit, or one divisional regiment, RNZAC, and they carried that armoured reconnaissance piece right throughout to the late 20th century. They've been re-raised in QAMR, as I'll go into. CMT, or Compulsory Military Training, which was 1949, so there might be some CMT veterans in the room, and then 1950, Korean War begins. CMT obviously went up into the, I believe, the early 70s, 1972, I think. Korean War begins 1950, and again, RNZAC soldiers are rotated through as part of the United Nations forces. K-Force did not deploy New Zealand armour, but individual personnel went through. In 1958, we re-raised QAMR as an armoured regiment, and throughout the 50s, the RNZAC was modernised, including the procurement of the Centurion tank, which sits proudly at Waiunu, out the front of the Army Museum there. Just where you can turn right into the Shell Station, or the Z. That is the largest, heaviest, main battle, the only main battle tank we've ever had. Okay, it was procured off the British tank to in anticipation of an armoured brigade, which never came to fruition. But what's interesting is photos of this thing being transported from Wellington off a ship to Wairu. You think we have problems with the roadworks now? This thing really shut things down big time. And this gets to a problem that endures today is New Zealand roads for armoured vehicles. So yeah, let's go buy some tanks. Yeah, a bit of a problem with that. With what's going on.
Well, they have to dismount them off the trucks.
That's right.
To get across all the rivers.
Yeah.
Instead of going, because bridges couldn't handle
the
weight.
Yeah, there's photos. Yeah. And then the light tank down the right is the M1 Walker Bulldog, which was used up to the early 80s.
Yeah.
The other one too is bottom left was Exercise Powder 164. So 100 years after the regiment had formed, we then move into this, which is the Gedon was taken. So they needed to get a Gedon out because they were accepted for public duties in London, which is a massive honour. The Gedon was taken out of Harwira, out of the church at Harwira, because that's where it was laid up, and it was taken to Buckingham Palace from Harwira. So an almost reversal of a torch type situation, but it's quite an amazing story. And then 50 personnel, QAMR, was given the honour of doing public duties at the Tower of London, Buckingham Palace and James Palace, and the Bank of England in London, 1964, in the bottom left there. And according to the stories, if you read the books, supposedly told off by the Queen Mother at night for being too loud in their foot drill. but not sure about that. Vietnam, 1964 to 72, RNZAC soldiers are rotated through Vietnam. The current Colonel Commandant, Colonel Trevor McComish, served in Vietnam, as did a number of other RNZAC personnel, and sort of they were rotated through and served alongside the artillery regiments, headquarters units, and sort of the Australian or US Army units. And that individual placement within partner nations is a theme that carries on today. 1968, we introduced the APCs, which are the M113, and that's the longest serving armoured vehicle we've had in the New Zealand Army. And then 1970, we've had the RFTF hybrid Queen Alexandra's Waikato Wellington Squadron. At least the Waikato name still remains today for Waikato mounted rifles. And in 1982, we had the Scorpion introduced. As you'll see in the next slides, Scorpion CVRT, or Combat Vehicle Reconnaissance Tracked, I think is the term. That is a petrol-powered Jaguar engine, very fast, but relatively dangerous. And was in service up until the 1990s, but gave the Armoured Corps gave QAMR a very good reconnaissance capability with a bit of firepower with a 76mm cannon, I believe. But there were some problems. I get again, petrol engine in an armoured vehicle is a bit nerve-wracking. In 1982, we're back to a Queen Alexandra Squadron as part of the first armoured group. And then we move into the present day. So, of course, after the Cold War, the army was reduced in size dramatically. I think 5,000 regulars down to 4,300, which has echoes today. And we, 1903, Queen Alexandra's Mounted Rifles is re-established or stood up again as a regiment for the next decade. 1994, Op Radian in Bosnia. So a mechanised country, and you might remember the TV or the news stories about this deployment and the questions of, whilst they were under a British umbrella for people out of a higher British formation, it really highlighted, is the New Zealand equipment up to standard? Protective equipment such as body armour, the APCs, our weapon systems. It was a real test, I guess, of New Zealand Army's capability in the early 90s. And there were real questions about, were we able to look out and protect ourselves or those soldiers? because a mechanised company of an armoured vehicle or APC mounted infantry company is something that New Zealand does quite often, but it's something that we need to sort of throw up a few weaknesses which we've spent the next 30 years probably trying to address. 1997, you'll see that we withdrew the Scorpions from service. So the top right, yeah, that's the UN mission in Bosnia. The Scorpion shelled down to the bottom left, operating in Wairau. And then, of course, in 1999, the troops, New Zealand troops, were deployed to East Timor, where a troop of APCs was deployed to provide protection, firepower, and off-road mobility. Interestingly, if you read the Matthew Wright's book, Colonel James Kyo, who was the troop leader at the time, talked about being on board the ship heading for Dili. Got told you go to Suwai, we're going to do an offload. You can't land on the beach, you're going to do an offload. And was shown a video, shown a TV or VCR tape with how to do that with no prior training. Just so that they got ashore eventually. But again, even though the APCs were showing their age by the stage, they still provided the speed, protection, and firepower to sort of combat the militia across the border. The battalion was there until early 2003, they came home. And then we get into an interesting time for defence and for the army. Any ex-Air Force in the room? Anyone? There you go. The Skyhawk, the F-16, the LAD purchase, third frigate. This was a very, very interesting time of fiscal constraints and what do we purchase. And again, looking at an armoured vehicle, can see the cost that we gave, the cost that was earmarked for the lab, and then what we ended up spending was, as always happens with military equipment, spirals a lot higher than what we think. And you had, I guess, at those times, decisions had to be made, as they always are, about what are we actually invested. And we bought 105 NZ Labs. The intent was to motorise the New Zealand Army. That's fine, but what you also have to buy are supporting vehicles. This thing here can do, I believe it's 110 k's an hour. Very fast.
Yep.
But you have to buy vehicles that can keep up with that. If you want to motorise your army. And that's the sort of things that sort of come up there. So, a great purchase, but again, it sort of has had its limitations as well. Then what they said was, we don't need an armoured corps. We're going to give the lab to the infantry, we have motorised infantry. Again, that's what other countries do. But then once you had a chief of army changing over, General Winterbride, Blackshield Dodson, and then you had a thinking that, well, actually, the armoured corps know how to operate these vehicles. Let's actually just combine the armoured corps and the infantry together into one RNZIR. Let's leave 2nd-1st as light infantry. And then that's where 1RNZIR came from. So QAMR went from a regiment back to a squadron, was sent down to Burnham to provide LAV support to 2nd 1st Battalion down at Burnham, and 1RNZIR became essentially one 1st New Zealand Cavalry Regiment was how it was looked at. In 2009, the LAV was used to support the Napier siege, Jan Molliner, which it was claimed he is an ex-RNZAC territorial soldier. So that was used to get the SDGM close to retrieve the slain police officer's body and showed its domestic utility as well, and I'll go into cover operations later. QAMR is also used to help with the relief efforts of the Christchurch earthquakes, including having the LAV on the court, which is a pretty good indicator to not steal things. And in 2011, we said, no, we got that wrong a decade ago, let's bring QAMR back as a unit. And so we're back to a full-size QAMR regiment. And from 2012 until today, that's where we are at. And below there is what the regiment consists of. Regimental headquarters, the New Zealand Scottish Squadron, in a homage back to the Scottish infantry and then the Scottish armoured units. Wellington East Coast Squadron, support squadron. When I say support squadron, that is our sort of the logistic support squadron. Has a full workshops capability and sort of supplies. So they make up almost a third of the regiment, because these things here do not go anywhere without a very, very big logistics train. And the people that we have, both civilian and military, who operate, who keep these things going, are very, very good at what they do, and unfortunately for us, are very, very high demand in the civilian sector. But we're keeping our head above water. And then below is the Waikato Mounted Rifle Squadron, or the Army of the Army Reserve, based up in Hamilton, which offer a very, very good linkage to the past, but again, they're quite hard to actually sort of. It gets harder and harder for them because the complexity of this vehicle for reservists to operate is tough. And in 2011, we had our first lab deployed to Afghanistan in support of NZSAS operations. And then we had, in 2012, Bagheq, or termed the Battle of Bagheq. What happened there, I guess, was the New Zealand French Reconstruction Team was engaged in went to the aid of the Afghan police, and then from there, a firefight ensued. We had two New Zealanders killed, Rory Malone and Pranay Dara. Pranay Dara was a member of QAMR, and six wounded, including current serving member of QAMR. Now, that was a real punch in the face for the New Zealand Army. I was working in HQ Headquarters Joint Forces at the time, and that sort of level of casualty, you know, I guess, incident, well, they may have to place it, but that level of sort of combat for the New Zealand Army was unheralded for quite some time, and it sort of had a real big impact on, I guess, New Zealand Army for a while. The bottom point, so that all those pictures there show lab operations in Afghanistan. Below there we have the Protective Mobility Project, which is launched, looking for a vehicle to lift troops and enhance survivability against IEDs and mines. And from that we got the Bushmaster, which you may have seen driving through Palmerston North as it's going through its testing and training phases. Now I'm just going to make a few plugs here. This is not a lab replacement. Tell your friends, this is not a lab replacement. The Bushmaster is a vehicle designed to take infantry or personnel safely to the fight, but not get into the fight. Okay? So you dismount, you drive, you dismount from your horse, and then you fight as infantry. The LAV stays in the fight with the infantry. The firepower this thing can bring, you stay in the fight. And it is an infantry fighting vehicle or an armoured fighting vehicle.
Is that got a main gun or is it just a 50 cal?
Well, so a LAV, 25mm chain gun.
No.
Yep, cannon, yep. Same as a Bradley, which has destroyed. Same gun as a Bradley, which has destroyed Russian armour in the Ukraine.
Yeah.
Yep. This thing here is a V-shaped hull,
yeah,
which deflects blasts, so it protects people from IEDs, it protects you from explosions, but it is not designed to go in the fight. Like the start of last year, QAMR, we responded to Cyclone Gabriel. We deployed a LAV troop up through Murupara, around through the Uruwetas to Wairoa, and they were the first outside people that some of those townships had seen once Gabriel had come through. In photos of that, it looked pretty similar to an operation in Afghanistan, if I'm brutally honest. But it showed the NZ LAV, minus the firepower, of course, the utility of that vehicle in an HADR environment, and it's the same with these things. Last year, we also led the first deployment of a LAV combat team on Exercise Talisman Sabre since 2019. We were held up by COVID with our training over that four-year period, but the Australians, the Americans, etc., we are still seen as being very, very good at combat team, squadron company level operations. In 2023, last year, so these are all now in the country, or 43, and we are introducing and going through the coursing now. So here we are at 2024. We continue the bear the same name as the predecessor troop established in Whanganui in 1864. So it's been a very quick rattle through 160 years of history, I understand that. But the bottom two photos are not New Zealand vehicles. So I don't want to scare you that the government's been on some sort of spending spree that you guys weren't aware of. But the bottom two vehicles on the left is the Australian Redback infantry fighting vehicle. And on the right is the Australian Boxer, which is a reconnaissance infantry fighting vehicle, but also a reconnaissance platform. these things here, where the Australians are going, again, don't work for New Zealand. Yes, they're very expensive, but this thing, the size of this boxer here, it would not fit on New Zealand roads. You have to get a repair team to come out to change the tyre. But on NZ Lav, our crews change them themselves. These avionics and ability of this thing to see and to shoot is amazing, but again, that comes with its own limitations. And so this shows that New Zealand, the Army, has got a decision to make as the Lav moves further and further. So it's 20 years old now, so it hasn't got that long to go. What is our next vehicle going to be? And do we stay in the primary combat vehicle game? But to be an Army that has vehicles in the fight, that's what we need to be. So again, not my decision, hopefully, but yes. So again, unfortunately, military equipment, it just gets more and more expensive. Inflation happens in uniform too. So I thank you for listening to that very, very quick 160 years. It came down to just over 45, 50 minutes. And if there are any questions, I'll now gladly take them. Sir?
How many Bushmasters are we buying and who's going to operate them?
So we're buying 43.
Yep.
And that's a number of variants. So that's not just troop carriers, but you have command and control, ambulance, and specialist vehicles for sort of signals and communications, etc. At the moment, QAMR is introducing the vehicle because the armoured subject matter expertise resides in our unit. But decisions about who the future users are is up to Army. Personnel-wise, QAMR, to crew another 43 Bushmasters on top of the left, I'd have people sort of try and drive vehicles at the same time, which can get untidy. So, yeah, that's the question facing us, but that's how many we're buying.
Do you think that we have to make a decision to buy American sort of vehicles because we need to align with our allies? I mean, we're not going to buy Chinese, are we?
No. There's a few problems there. I think you would have heard in the media about Plan Anzac and their alignment to Australia, which gives us clarity. It's long overdue. You could say, why are we taking so long to make that decision? But, therefore, we need to look at what the first port of call always be, what are the Australians doing? And we've seen that with the NH90, although the Australians have pivoted on that one, the Spire rifle, the Uni Mog truck. But again, equipment like this is not practical for New Zealand. So this is the question about where do we go? But yeah, partnered, and the other danger you can get yourself into is what you call orphan capability. So if a country makes a bit of equipment, but it's quite bespoke or quite unique, and you go and buy that, you might be the only user in the region. You might be, so I think with the Sea Sprite naval helicopters, I think they're flying by us and the Egyptians, potentially one other country. So you have a bit of a problem there about, if the US and Australia use it, then you've got a supply chain and you've got a sort of logistics base that can support the fleet. So that's where we've got to be careful. Does that answer your question?
Yeah,
just need some spare parts.
Just I don't know if you can answer it. You know, when you're going back between you started taking armour on, I'm doing a bit of a building model collection in New Zealand armour vehicles. And I've been talking to a guy in the Army Museum, and he said that we originally were given Matildas, or infantry mark II tanks, but they were too heavy for the New Zealand race. They didn't have got the Valentines. Is that true?
This is a technical question I warned myself about at the start of the presentation.
Because they can't find the Matildas. There was about 50 or 60 of them they bought, and they were originally...
So I was reading it. So again, this is where Matthew Wright's book is fantastic, because it really does outline what they did into war, and it talks about... It actually gives a description of every armoured vehicle that's ever been in service. So that's where the answer would be. To be honest, I haven't looked in that level of detail.
I believe that is the case.
Yeah.
Because the first New Zealand Armoured Brigade that was the training unit in Wairu during World War II actually had Matildas, and they couldn't get out of Wairu, for that very reason.
And I reckon they can't find them either.
Oh, yeah. I think, actually, I thought that the Mayor and Councillor Arnold would be here tonight. Councillor Arnold knows the answer because he's a bit of a member of military vehicles.
Why didn't you give the presentation?
I'm not sure, but I know out of Rangatira there are a couple under construction or under refurbishment, and I think one of them is a Matilda. Is that right, Peter? You know,
I think so. Yeah.
I remember going out there a few weeks ago, and he's got an APC there and undercover under a tarp, I believe, was a Matilda.
Yeah, really? Yeah. Yeah. The number of restored armoured vehicles in this country is quite frightening. I saw the newspaper the other day, some guy's got a British one, it's a 4-1, what is it?
You know, in the hay barns and collections out in the countryside, you'd be amazed at what's floating around these.
Conversion of ring gun carriers.
And the condition of them.
Oh, yeah.
Real fly power.
Absolutely.
And you know, you've got a little speed record for a Scorpion, too.
Sorry?
New Zealand Army, or the QMR, got the world speed record for a Scorpion. Mm.
Here we go.
I can see the jacket. I can tell you about one or two things about what I'm talking about. It's really about the Russell Range. We blew the crap out of them without our AFE gun records.
Okay.
Because after it was over, we hoisted the green flags and then we went over an M41 just to inspect the damage. There were about half a dozen Centurions, some Honeys, and we all blew them. So if you want a Matilda, that's the place to go.
Any other questions?
Where's QS located now and its components?
Yeah, so it's like Linton. So if you, those of you who are familiar with Linton, I know some of you in the room, still work at Linton? Chater Hangars, which were established for 1RNZIR. So where 1RNZIR headquarters is, if you know where that is, Linton, just over the road, is
Chater. I wasn't asking that detail. When I was in, QA was in Waiuru.
Yep.
It was very easy. You decide you're going to have an exercise, you drove out the back door and you're in a training area. Now you have a logistics problem of getting them to Waiuru to start with.
No, well, Lav,
how they get on now?
So Lav is roadworthy, so you convert them for road. You have the high-vis panels, you put the driver's screen up, you put the screens up in the turret, and they can deploy up to... In fact, you'll see some tomorrow night at the Warriors game, because they've driven up to Auckland. We do have the heavy transporting vehicle, 4 armoured vehicles, but generally we can self-deploy LAV to anywhere in the country because on the road they are fine. Same with the Bushmaster. And that is the benefit of wheeled vehicles, but then you lose the mobility once you get into the off-road situation. So, yes, Waiuru was a lot easier when QAMR was there. And what we'll do now is we'll deploy up to Waiuru. Melbourne Lines, as you'll remember, is still there. Lockwood's is still there. We can operate out of there and the exercises, but we are basing, the unit is based in it.
And NZ Scots?
NZ Scots has been disbanded.
Oh.
It was disbanded in 2013. And we have the Scottish Squadron. So we have NZ. So we have the NZ Scottish Squadron as one of the regular 4 squadrons in QAMR at Linton. So we've retained. So we retained the Scottish. We've retained the Scottish Links. We retained the Kill. Any of you go to the Turakina Highland Games, you'll see the NZ Scottish Squadron represented there. But so we've retained the Links, but the Scots Squadron down in Dunedin and First Scots down in Christchurch and Burnham, and Second Scots down in Dunedin disbanded. And as a territorial force unit was suspended in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
So Tekapo, the hangars down there haven't been occupied by APCs for quite some time.
Oh,
I saw
a question.
Just one
more.
Curious about the Gideon, about where it's housed now. Is it back in Hawera or is it in Linton?
The Gideon's in Linton. So if you walk into QAMR headquarters, it's encased right in the foyer of the headquarters as you walk in. Yeah, it's the centrepiece of the whole. At the moment, we need to take the WEC Gideon back over to the Hastings Council Chambers to actually be laid up back in there, which is,
All right, I think we've pretty much exhausted that. Some of us have got to get up at 4 o'clock tomorrow morning, so You know, we're losing out on our beauty sleep. But look, just want to make a few thanks again, certainly to Jacob for a very informative presentation. 160 years is a lot to cover, and as one of the oldest units in the New Zealand Army, you've done well. In fact, you were beget 1 year before we were, the Engineer Volunteers in 1865, so you've done well.
Still the win. Hey, that's just I know that in the room we have ex-armoured soldiers, we have ex-army, and we have ex-defence force, or air force, and potentially navy as well. I just want to let you all know, rest assured, that the soldiers, sailors, and aviators today are professional, they're commissioned, and I just really ask that you engage with them. If you're at Anzac Day tomorrow and stuff, engage with them, and rest assured that they're just as professional and committed to their service as you all were, and the previous generations have been. So we're doing okay, but yeah, engage with them at Anzac Day, and you know, have a chat to them. Because they really love it too, sort of talking to people who've also sort of served in that bond there as well. So thank you very much for that.
Yeah, and a final round of applause.